feel it's their appointed duty. They keep trying to tell me, all you want to do is use me. But my answer, they don't want that use me stuff.
Merry Monday morning, South Florida. Fernando Monte back here on the airwaves of News Radio 610. WIOD, rested and recharged after just a gorgeous holiday weekend. Easter, Passover, a lot of the biggies intertwining for those of the Judeo-Christian faith. Had a chance to take the kiddies yesterday to an Easter egg hunt. And, you know, it's such a beautiful thing when they're still young and that means something to them and to you. But I got to tell you, the Easter egg hunt that I went to, there were probably about, 40 kids, and there were a lot of eggs before the hunt started. And, you know, they get all the kids ready to go and this, that, and the other. And they finally do the countdown, and it's 3, 2, 1, go. And I looked at it on my watch. It was 20 seconds before the hunt was over. In other words, all of the kids had taken all of the eggs in 20 seconds. Scotty Mendick, I know you're a young father. Did you take Anthony out for an Easter egg hunt yesterday, or is he a little too much in the crib for that kind of action this early on?
Yeah, he can't even sit up straight yet by himself, so well, listen, no Easter egg hunt.
From one dad advice to another, when you go to the Easter egg hunts in the future, I'm curious if anybody else had to deal with this. Make sure you lay out a game plan. It's almost like war. It's like lightning war. You got to attack quickly and get to it right away, because it's like locust. In 20 seconds, all of the eggs were gone. And then you got to deal with the tears, and you got to deal with the, wait a minute, I only got two eggs. I mean, they didn't warn us parents for that.
I'll be the one having to apologize to other parents for what my child did to their child for, like, you know, getting all the Easter eggs eventually, most likely.
No, you're going to be the dad. You're going to be like that soccer dad that just starts bowling over. I actually saw a couple of parents. It's amazing, like, the beast that is brought out of parents and these sorts of things, you know, in defense of their child. They started, like, boxing out and doing screens and picks, basketball style, of other little kids trying to get eggs because they wanted to get their kids getting
eggs. I'm going to teach my kid the same thing my father taught me. It's like, if you want something, you got to go get it. You're going to cry about it after? Well, then you should have been at the front of the line there trying to push those kids over and grabbing it. And, you know, that's what I said. I'm going to have to apologize to others. I'm sorry my son pushed your son to get that Easter egg. I apologize, sir.
Look at you, law of the jungle, Darwinistic approach to parenting when it comes to the Easter egg hunt. You know, here it is. It's supposed to be a nice, whimsical, innocent little event.
And nobody's gonna give it to you there, Fernand, man. You got to get it yourself, man.
But the thing was, you know, I'm actually kind of a competitive person myself. So next year I'm going to pull up like Shun Tzu and I'm going to come up with some battle plans and talk to my kids. All right, we got to divide and conquer to get most eggs.
You do the old football thing. You put a cast on your kid's arm so when he goes out there, he throws the elbow.
Butkus style, right?
Butkus style, He'll do the old Ric Flair trick. He'll have a pair of brass knuckles in his trunk, so as soon as, you know, nobody's looking, he'll slip them out and knock them on and then slip it back in.
You know, it's sad, but they say that you got to, like, teach your kids the way of the world. But this Easter egg hunt for me was kind of a little microcosm of that. But to see some of these parents, like, really go all out. I mean, look, there's Easter eggs. They're plastic little eggs with basically trinkets inside, of the value of which is less than a penny in some cases. But they were just going for it. I think what we may do in the future, so as to avoid this, you know, law of the jungle, we may do it like a family style one. We limit the invitations, limit the attendance, lay out a bunch of eggs, and that way the kids have more fun, because you go to these public events and it's like a stampede.
I don't know. I honestly never have gone to one of the public ones before. I've always done them with family and friends, like, you know, like you said, private events. So do they actually hide these Easter eggs in places that...
No, they were like in plain sight. But here's where it gets really scary. Here's where it gets really frightening. This was a church. This was at a church where the Easter egg hunt was held. So, you know, you figure, well, there's going to be like this peace and love. People have just come out of Sunday Easter Mass. So everybody's in a warm... No, man, it was like the storming of the beach at D-Day. Boom, you saw those kids go out there and everybody was just trying to knock over whoever was in their path. So, yeah, that was how my weekend was spent. And I actually got a little chance on a Saturday before all the Easter festivities took in. I want to thank the lovely Chanel, my wife, who just insisted I take a little R&R. had a chance to camp out at the Diplomat in Hollywood Beach. Beautiful resort. Just laid out on the beach all day long. Look a little bit like a lobster now, but it was well worth it. And sometimes you got to recharge those batteries. So it was also good not to think about you-know-who. You know who I'm talking about, Scotty. The man who like haunts all of our dreams at night. As much as you don't want to talk about him, as much as you don't want to think about him, he's there all the time, up to no good, making ruckuses. And in this week, no exception. He was amongst us. I could feel those vibes. The 19th trip to a golf course. 19 trips. And it's funny because in the first 84 days, you go back to the last four presidents, right? Who have been the last four presidents? Of course, we're talking about Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Obama, and Donald Trump. And it's you know, an even split between Republicans and Democrats in that mix. So it's a nice apples to apples to apples to apples sample. Now, I think we have Trump on record, don't we, Scotty? We have some sound of Trump saying during the campaign how he would act when it came to what he would
do. I'm going to be working for you. I'm not going to have time to go play golf.
He said he wasn't going to have time. Why not, Scotty? Why didn't he say he was going to have time to play golf? You remember that one? Well, he in essence said that he had a lot of the nation's business to do. He wasn't going to be able to leave the White House. There was just so much going on. To make America great again, it required every ounce of devotion, of energy, of focus. Every second couldn't be wasted.
I love golf, and I have some of the greatest golf courses in the world. I own Doral. I own some of the great, one of Turnberry in Scotland, where they have the British Open. So I have the greatest stuff. But you know what? And I love golf. But if I were in the White House, I don't think I'd ever see Turnberry again. I don't think I'd ever see Doral again. I own Doral in Miami. I don't think I'd ever see many of the places that I have. I don't ever think I'd see anything. I just want to stay in the White House and work my ass off, make great deals, right? Who's going to leave?
He's going to leave. Well, I've got the numbers now. And again, facts, folks, facts, F-A-C-T-S, not fake news. Despite what a lot of people like to say, here are the numbers, and they're pretty stark. During the first 84 days of their respective presidencies, Bill Clinton went to the golf course three times in the first 84 days, three. George W. Bush, zero, as in never went, George W. Bush. Barack Obama, how many times did he go to the golf course, Scotty, in his first 84 days? Got any guesses? Take a guess. He went a lot. Remember, he was the big golfer. Trump had a problem with his golfing. How many times?
I would say probably four times.
Four times in his first 84 days, Barack Obama? Sure. Barack Hussein Obama, as some people like to call him?
Sure.
You know, that guy who was a Muslim Kenyan plant there to destroy the country, blah, blah, blah. He went to the golf course exactly zero times. Barack Obama, zero times during his first 84 days because, you know, he had a lot to deal with. And that's what a responsible president does. The economy was on the verge of collapse. He was trying not to squander any of the political capital of his first 100 days. So he went zero times. Donald Trump, the same guy who said he wasn't going to be able to leave the White House, has gone to play golf here in South Florida. But overall, he's gone to play golf 19 times. 19 times. 19 times. And, you know, the fact that he's on the golf course that much is insulting. It's shameful. It's embarrassing. But, you know, if that were the only thing, it'd be bad. It'd be really bad because, you know, you got this guy who's a pathological liar saying he was never going to leave the White House because he had too much work to do to make America great again to go golfing. He's gone 19 times. Here is where the insult just gets ugly. $25 million is what he has spent thus far. Not even 4 months in office. $25 million just going golfing. In Barack Obama's 8 years, the entire 8 years of his presidency, the travel costs were $97 million. 8 years. And this was a guy, remember he kept saying, get off the golf course, Obama, get off the golf course. All you're doing is playing golf instead of focusing
Obama,
on the American.
It was reported today, played 250 rounds of golf, and he's going to be in Hawaii, I think. Did they say for 3 weeks? How can a president, for 3 weeks? I don't have time for that. I love golf. I think it's one of the greats, but I don't have time. 250 rounds, that's more than a guy who plays on the PGA Tour plays. He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods. No, think of it. We don't have time for this.
Yeah. Do as I say, not as I do, Donald Trump. Listen to what the cost, the projected cost for Trump will be if he keeps up this pace. He's already spent $25 million, so he's already at a quarter of what Obama spent in 8 years inside of 4 months. But, you know, there's no money for Meals on Wheels. There's no money for the National Endowments of the Arts. There's no money for Sesame Street, right? If this pace continues, it will be $700 million in travel costs at the end of 8 years. Think about that when you think about your president, our president, Donald J. Trump. Got to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of your calls, folks, at 866-610-6397. Also, giving away those tickets today, the first Trump town hall of the first 100 days. Going to be doing it at WIOD with special guests Roger Stone and John Schindler. Get those phones ready, folks. Pretty soon, we're going to be giving away tickets on air. We'll be back with more on the Fernando Mondi Show on News Radio 610 WIOD.
And when Israelis and Arabs are on the same page,
South Florida's voice,
people should pay attention.
One call at a time. News Radio 610 and online at WIOD.
Fernando Mondi back on News Radio 610 WIOD. Scotty, I'm so excited. I know we've been talking about this. I know we've been kind of teasing folks. We're going to kind of let them win tickets, but I want to do it right now. I want to give away tickets right now, Scotty. Can we do it? Am I allowed? Do I have that permission and right as the host of this show?
What Fernand wants, Fernand gets.
Scotty, happy host, happy life, right? That's there right. You go. I'm going to modify that one a little bit. All right, folks, here's the opportunity. Monday, May 1st from 7 to 9 p.m. at the iHeart Southwest Airlines soundstage, we're going to be hosting, I guarantee it to you, folks, it is going to be the best 100-day town hall of the Trump presidency anywhere in America, powered by our friends at Primary Care Physicians of Hollywood. And with our very special VIP guests representing the Trump position, Roger Stone, Trump consigliere, Trump friend, Trump advisor, also author of the brand new book, The Making of the President 2016. And on the opposite side, John Schindler, the national security columnist for the Observer newspaper, formerly of the National Security Agency and decidedly in the anti-Trump column. We're going to be giving away our first free pair of tickets right now to caller number 6 at 866-610-6397. Folks, it promises to be a heck of an evening with refreshments, good conversation, and your opportunity. If you're in the audience, you're going to get to talk to Roger Stone and John Schindler and give us your take on the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. 100 days, by the way, Scotty, that right now ain't doing so good. And if you look at where the heat is concentrated more and more, you hear about Steve Bannon being made up, being served up as the scapegoat. I read a really interesting piece over the weekend in Vanity Fair that suggested that right now, as Roger Stone told us first on this program, he is isolated, he is alone, and he is trying a counter strategy to keep relevant. Some people say threatening through surrogates to stay on board or else he is going to open up a can of revenge. You heard of this guy named Mike Cernovich, Scotty? You heard about this guy? He's one of these alt-right, Bannon-esque Trump bots out there in the cyberspace, cybersphere. Well, this is a guy who is, you know, he's very much in the conspiracy theory, but he basically said, in no uncertain terms, if Trump fires Bannon, he is going to destroy marriages in the White House. He is going to reveal all of the dirt about all of the innuendo, the affairs, the lusts, all of that ugly stuff, those secrets that are taking place behind the doors at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That has been his overt, explicit threat. Now, that sounds like blackmail to me. That sounds like a prosecutable offense. But that's what he's saying. He says if Bannon goes, all of the secret goes. All of the marriages in the White House go. So there's a lot going on. But 866-610-6397, caller number 6 is going to be the winner to those big, big tickets for the soundstage event that we're going to be doing on Monday, May 1st from 7 to 9 p.m. at the iHeart Southwest Airlines soundstage. sponsored by WIOD and powered by our friends at Primary Care Physicians of Hollywood. Speaking of revealing White House secrets. Oh, actually, do we got our first winner, Scotty? All right. Should we talk to him now? Let's talk to the man. Who is the big winner? Mark Otto. Congratulations. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning and happy Easter belated. I already had a great weekend. This just extends it. Thank you so much. It's awesome.
Listen, it's going to be a great time, an interesting time. But let me take advantage, Mark, while I got you on the phone. Give us your grade right now. Trump 100 days thus far. What grade would you give him at day 85?
Okay, you're talking about like a grade from A to F or whatever right now. I'm very conservative. I hope I'm not disappointing you. I'm liking the direction, but I'm not going to give anything higher than a C+ because I'm still waiting to see what's going on. Sorry about that. I'm sort of in the middle.
Right, listen, let me tell you something, Mark. Don't worry about disappointing me, okay? This is America, and on this program, on this station, you will always have a right to your opinion. Doesn't matter what I think. It matters what you think. But listen, we're excited.
Well,
you're going to be.
I still want to see more. I mean, I don't really believe we're on the verge of nuclear war, but I believe we're on the verge of some kind of smackdown with Korea, and I'm just waiting to see what goes on.
Well, did you see what?
I listen to you guys 24/7.
Did you see Mark what the vice president said? He's now in South Korea, and he said he threatened North Korea with military actions if it continues their nuclear program. And you know what the problem with a threat like that is, right? You can't unwalk that kind of a threat.
No. You cannot put the genie back in the bottle.
You can't put the genie back in the bottle. And Mark, I mean, listen, I'm sure you sound like a level-headed guy, even though we're probably on opposite sides politically. You don't see any case where a nuclear war, nuclear exchange is justified, do you?
I mean, if they're going to use it, I know we're going to use it. I don't think it'll go that far. I just don't. I know I'm saying no, but because I'm also saying I don't believe it's going to happen. I just think that there's going to be some kind of intervention. I'm pretty sure a God-fearing man, and I don't think God's going to allow that to happen, if I can say that. I just don't think that's going to go that far. But something terrible is going to happen. There's still going to be a lot of lives cost. What's the difference whether it's conventional or nuclear? There's going to be some lives spent. There's no
doubt.
But,
you know, is this what you voted for Donald Trump? Because he promised exactly the opposite of this. And that's the question I have, Mark. We'll talk about this at the town hall on May 1st with Roger Stone and John Schindler. But he said America first. He wasn't going to get us involved in a bunch of entanglements, whether it be in Syria, whether it be continuing the war in Afghanistan or continuing the war in Iraq. He said that was a great disaster. Now North Korea. And now we are on the prospect, Mark, of three combat theaters outside of the borders of the United States. And this is the question I have for so many people who supported Trump. How could this possibly be what you voted for when he campaigned against this? That's the question I ask all the time.
For now, all I know is I just knew these were already festering. He inherited these problems, and I think Korea should have been taken care of a long time ago. I don't have an answer specifically for your question, but I just felt like this should have been taken care of a long time ago. That's all I really can say at this point.
Well, we will take it up on day 100, Mark, May 1st, and you just won tickets. Thanks for calling in. Congratulations, by the way. Hey, everybody, when we come back, we're going to meet the South Florida Press and our guest is not a new Pulitzer Prize winner. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. We will now talk to Jim Morin from the Miami Herald. Two-time, dos, baby, dos, dos equis, dos, two Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist from the Herald. When we come back next on News Radio 610 WIOD.
News Radio 610 WIOD.
Fernando Monte back on News Radio 610 WIOD. And folks, there's just something about our next guest. There's something special about him. We've had him on the program a couple of times before. We're always honored to have him. But now, he used to be Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist from the Miami Herald, Jim Morin. Now you can add the multiple in front of his name. It's the two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. That's right, Jim Morin from the Miami Herald. Welcome back to the program, Jim, and congratulations on your double fisting of the Pulitzers, sir.
That was a real shocker, I have to tell you. Well, it really was.
You know, if you were a fair and honest man, Jim Morin, in your acceptance speech, you probably thanked profusely the President of the United States for just being an unending source of creativity and material.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know,
he's a big part of it.
I got to tell you, Jim Morin, a lot of people thought wrongly, but they thought that the era of the editorial cartoon is over. I think we're entering a golden age thanks to the president. If that's his greatest accomplishment, I think it's making guys like you the must-stop thing for newspapers nowadays.
It is. Well, in newspapers, I mean, our biggest competitors now are guys like, John Stewart's not around anymore, but he still is that kind of comedy. John Simon, the guy who used to be on The Daily Show, is incredible, and there are a bunch of shows with really super satire going on. Bill Maher is brilliant, and his writers are brilliant. And so those people are, you know, those are the guys that we're sort of up against, and it's really, really difficult because they're amazing.
You know, you say that, Jim Morin, and you probably don't even know how right on the money you are. There is a new cover story out in The Atlantic entitled, Can Satire Save the Republic? I know it's certainly kept guys like me who just think Donald Trump is the worst disgrace and embarrassment ever to belie this wonderful country of ours. But I think satire, to your point, is really acting maybe as a counterweight. And we see that, of course, in the success that you've had and in the brilliant work that you seem to be putting out on a daily basis. Jim Morin, though, before we move on to that, I just want to ask you, what is it like for you? I mean, the pinnacle of your profession is winning the Pulitzer Prize. You've now done it twice. Do you kind of feel like, mic drop, I'm out, I've done everything I need to do? Or you get greedy like Bill Belichick, you just want that next one and the one after that? What's it feel like, Jim Morin?
No, I don't. I've never really paid attention to it. I just enter it and see what happens. It's been 21 years since I won the last one, and all I want to do every year is, or actually from cartoon to cartoon, is just to make them better. And I think one of the reasons I've been successful is that I'm my own worst critic. I look at what I do, and I look at the drawing, and I just see that's wrong, and I wish I had all of them to do over again because I could, you know, do them much better. So it's really all, you know, it's a matter of drawing cartoons to me, and the awards they're nice. It's icing on the cake, and it's a couple of bucks too. But it's really the cartooning that makes a difference.
You know, Jim Morin, one of the reasons that I read every single day you have a new editorial cartoon out in the Miami Herald is because, I don't know, I just get a sense that truth is one of the guiding principles of your cartoons. And you're an equal opportunity offender, per se. You've gone after the Democrats as much as you have the Republicans. But am I wrong in suggesting or thinking, what is the role that truth plays when you're trying to convey something? I mean, is that a sacred thing for you, thinking of a situation that you know is fact-based, truthful, and then using your pen to lampoon the reality of it, but always with the concept of truth behind it? Is that a conscientious thing?
Yes. I think that's actually, I never thought of it that way, but I think you're right. And because when somebody says something and you know it's wrong and it can be proven wrong, that is really, that's gold to an editorial cartoonist or a satirist. That's when the ideas come and the ridicule gets really funny, I suppose. And so, I think that's probably the case. And it's why Donald Trump is such right material. For now, I mean, one thing, you know, this whole thing with Syria bombing, and it gets difficult. I mean, there's sometimes I can't put things into words, but this Syria bombing after the chemical attack, and Trump saying how much he feels for these little babies. You know, that's the way he says it. Babies, these little babies. Well, you know, this is a guy who is in favor of cutting health insurance to you know, tens of millions of people, many of whom are mothers with babies who would not have coverage. And so, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And personally, I think the whole thing is just a way of getting our minds off of the Trump-Russia connection and the election and all that stuff. And I feel the same way with what's going on with North Korea.
You know, Jim Warren, as I said at the outset,
screen.
I don't disagree in any way, shape, or form with that. But as I said at the outset, you know, one of the things you've been known for over the years is, you know, you've skewered politicians on both sides of the aisle, both here in this country and around the world. Is it fair to say that your pen is extra sharpened, though, for President Trump? I feel like there's almost, correctly in my judgment, but at least almost an intense focus and dislike. And if that's the case, what is the one thing, as you daily put together, you know, your blank canvas and you end up with the end result, is there one thing that has really galled you more than anything else that you feel that your cartoonist pen has done justice to exposing either the hypocrisy of or the flip-flop of or just the BS politician nature of?
Yeah, this is, well, it's, you know, you make it sound personal, and this isn't personal. I don't know this guy. I suppose the more you find out about him, not only his time and his short time in the presidency, but before that, he's did some pretty outrageous things before he became president. And I just, you know, it's just one thing after another. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, George W. Bush or Richard Nixon, or, you know, some of the more outrageous presidents we've had in our history, I just can't see anything equaling this at all. Just from a standpoint of competence or lack of, the lies that he constantly spews, irresponsible behavior. I mean, it's one thing after another, and it's actually kind of frustrating because there's so much that we have to deal with, that it can get frustrating because you wish you could draw 20 cartoons a week. You know, but there's not enough space.
Jim Warren, when you think, however, about, I mean, there's a lot of Americans out there. You know them. I know them. In many cases, there are friends and families that, for whatever reason, in spite of the lies, the reversals, the policy flip-flops, all of the inconsistencies, they are still supporting this man and what they regard as his agenda to make the country, quote-unquote, great again. What is the mental image that you think of that is conjured into your mind when you think of those folks that, even listening to this broadcast right now, just say, Jim Warren, you're wrong about Trump. Fernando Mondi, you're wrong about Trump. What is the mental picture that comes to mind of someone who can still be supporting someone like this with all of these inconsistencies in front of the world?
Well, they have their reasons, and I don't get personal about this. Long time ago, I decided that how I feel about this is quite simple. If I ever encounter somebody that supports Donald Trump, I just say, look, you know, I'll tell you what, in time, you'll figure it out. You know, you will. You'll figure it out. And I think more and more people who support him are starting to have second thoughts, especially now that he's really starting to go against what he said on the campaign trail, increasingly. So, I don't dislike people because of this. I've been doing this a long time, and it's just politics. And we all want the same thing. We all want this country to succeed, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think it's a fair criticism, though, when some of those folks say, you know, Jim Warren, you've got the power of the pen. It's mightier than the sword. You haven't really given Trump much of a chance. He's not even 100 days in yet. You think that's a fair criticism, a fair pushback, Jim Warren?
Oh, no, of course. Of course it is. I think it's completely fair. Look at what he's done. Those guys can't even do an Easter egg roll, and we're going to attack North Korea. I mean, I am fair-minded toward all these guys, and I'm fair-minded toward Trump as well. If he does something that works out well, I would give him credit for it. But right now, I think there's only one good thing to come out of what he's doing with cutting laws, regulating the environment. I think people have forgotten what the environment was like about 50 years ago, and that these regulations were put there for a reason. And I think people have forgotten why, because they've gotten used to, relatively clean air in Los Angeles, for example. They don't remember when it was like China. It was the smog was so bad. I think that it just gets to the point where this is going to be a reminder of why we have to do certain things, why we have to have regulations to help. Life to be better.
And no question.
Corporations for running everything.
Jim, I got to take a quick break. We're going to come back with your calls, your chance to speak to not a one, but two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, the Miami Herald's Jim Warren, editorial cartoonist, 866-610-6397. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about transparency or the lack of it. Also, the question of the White House visitor logs. You will not believe Donald Trump's answer for why he decided to not reveal the guests to the White House. He wants to keep those secret. We'll talk about it with Jim Warren when we come back on News Radio 610 WIOD.
News Radio 610 and online at WIOD.
You say yes, I say no.
No.
You say stop, and I say go, go, go. Oh, no. You say goodbye, and I say hello.
Fernando Monte back on News Radio 610 WIOD. Don't forget, folks, we're going to be giving another pair of tickets away to President Trump's first 100 days town hall again before the show is over. But you can also win by registering right now at WIOD.com. Your two chances to win. Go to WIOD.com, sign up and register, and you could be the big winner. As we continue our conversation, speaking of winners, with two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Jim Warren from the Miami Herald, without a doubt, the best editorial cartoonist alive and working today. And Jim Warren, I want you to think of this. Maybe it might give you a little inspiration for a new piece here. The White House on Friday said that it was ending the contract for the open.whitehouse.gov. This was the website that was set up by the prior administration, which discloses the visitor logs as well as all of the financial disclosure and salary information for White House employees. When asked why they were closing this, and I can't make this stuff up, Jim Warren. I can't make it up.
Yeah.
They said that it's a waste of taxpayer money, and that ending it would save $70,000 by the year 2020. This on the heels of Donald Trump taking 19 trips to the golf course that have already cost the American taxpayer $25 million. By the way, they've spent $35,000 on golf cart rentals for the Secret Service alone, and I haven't even gotten into the Melania Trump scenario at Trump Tower, which is costing as much as $50 million, I hear, potentially this year. Jim, how do they say that with a straight face?
You're asking me? I have no idea. He isn't the first guy to do that. I mean, I think Barack Obama was extraordinary in that sense. I think most of the prior presidents also didn't allow those logs to be made public. But I think they should be.
No, indeed they should. Jim, when you look at, I mean, so much of what you also are covering for the editorial pages of the Miami Herald with your cartoons has a national focus, but, you know, you're still a South Florida guy writing for a South Florida paper. What has also riveted and caught your attention from a local perspective?
Well, Rick Scott is a wonderful topic, and as is the legislature. It's frustrating because you just, with the legislature and Scott, you just say the same things over and over and over, and it just gets to be how it gets in the matter of how do you say the same thing in an original way, and so it gets more difficult with time, but. Those are my favorite topics, plus, you know, traffic and certain parts of life in South Florida. Global warming, too, by the way.
When you look at the government in South Florida, and, you know, we've seen it all in Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties, of course, and it doesn't really matter. You know, we have equal opportunity corruption on both sides of the aisle here. Yeah. But do you sense it's particularly egregious here? And is that a good thing for you? I mean, is that one of the silver linings of all of the graft and all of the mismanagement that we tend to see with our local officials down here?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, there are a lot of really good, nice, they're good characters. And that's, but I don't know. I think it hasn't been as much fun as it used to be. I used to really like Maurice Ferrer, and there was never a better character to draw locally for me than Joe Coraglio. Joe Coraglio was wonderful, especially when he had the mustache and he looked like, you know, a really sleazy used car salesman. He was such a character, and he's a really funny character in that he could say these outrageous things, and you'd just wail and go after him. And then he would, there are other times that he would be the lone voice of sanity on the Miami City Commission.
Well, you know, Jim, you may get your chance again because he's running for office, from what I understand. Joe Coraglio himself, the former mayor of the city of Miami, believe it or not. Yeah.
It's in his blood. You know, he goes to Doral and then that blows up. And I'm not surprised.
Well, Jim, but before we let you go, I just want to wish you congratulations again. I've been a fan and admirer for many years, but no one, I think, is more deserving of being a 2-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. By the way, where does that prize go in the Morin House? Like, is it by the is it a book stop? Do you hold it high on the mantelpiece? Where does that Pulitzer go in that place of honor in your home?
You know, first of all, what they look like, what they give you is, it basically looks like a diploma from Columbia University. And the one from the first one, I've never hung it. It's in a drawer somewhere, and I may hang it this time. I don't know. The cash award is nice, and it's already been spent a long time ago.
All right. Jim Morin, congratulations. We'll check you out again today and tomorrow, every single day in the pages of the Miami Herald and MiamiHerald.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Jim.
Great talking to you, Fernando. Take care.
Right. Take care. Folks, everybody knows the President of the United States is the leader of the free world, but many on the inside know that the Chief of Staff is a position that directly influences the President, and that their actions and inactions have defined the course of our country. Maybe some people think the most powerful position in all of government. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chris Whipple, author of the brand new book, Gatekeepers: How the White House Chief of Staffs Define Every Presidency. We're also going to be giving away another pair of tickets to the President First 100 Days Town Hall again before the show is over. But remember, you can also win by registering at WIOD.com. We take a look at the men behind the man when we come back on News Radio 610 WIOD. Fernando Monte back on News Radio 610 WIOD. And one of the most important positions in the federal government, the federal bureaucracy, and one of the most unheralded ones to those that are not political junkies like myself, is the chief of staff position. And believe it or not, the chief of staff position is not something that the framers of our republic, the founding fathers, really had in mind. when it came to drafting our system of government that has become a model for the world. It's really a modern phenomenon, the role of the chief of staff, the power, the influence that the chief of staff has, not only in determining the potential success or failure of a White House, but the role and the influence that that chief of staff has on the man he serves, the president of the United States. And joining us now is an author of a book. And I'm going to tell you, I'm really upset with this author of this book, because normally we get these books and, you know, you read a little bit and then you try to get up to speed on what you're going to talk about. And I couldn't put this book down. I started reading and it ended up being one of those binge reading sessions, almost like when you binge watch one of these series. And it's Chris Whipple and his book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chief of Staff Defined Every Presidency. Chris Whipple, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris, by the way,
sorry I kept you up all night.
I know. It's like, God, I'm going to send you my invoice for Motrin or whatever it was, the melatonin I had to take to go to sleep. That was just too good a book, an incredible book.
Thanks, appreciate it.
So, Chris, let me start with one of the things that really just jumped out to me. And keep in mind, this is a family friendly show, so I'm going to say a word in your book that's not quite so family friendly. A little phonetically, it's going to sound like it, but I want you to explain what a rat funk is, or a word that rhymes with rat funk, and why it's such an important word that I kept seeing like a mantra repeated over and over again in your book, The Gatekeepers.
Well, you know, let's fast forward. I mean, my book is really the untold story of 17 living White House chiefs of staff, going all the way back to Jerry Ford's administration. But what we're seeing right now in the White House is total dysfunction. I mean, it's the most dysfunctional White House in modern history, and the term that you referred to was a term that Jim Baker coined, and it would apply to this White House for sure. This is a case where, because of a combination of factors, the White House chief, who has made rookie mistake after rookie mistake, and quite frankly, you know, more fundamentally, a president who apparently does not want to have a grown-up in the room and a really empowered White House chief. The result is what you're seeing right now. It's real chaos at 1600 Pennsylvania.
Well, you know, your book opens, the curtain rises on your book at a meeting that took place with all, I think, virtually every single one of the 17 living chiefs of staff. And Rahm Emanuel, who was about to take the reins as the incoming chief of staff for President Obama in 2009, and it was really a unique historical moment because you had both of these, on both sides, you had the former chiefs of staff, the incoming chief of staff, representing the full spectrum of American politics over the last 40 years. And Rahm Emanuel said it was a critically important session for him. As far as your research into the book goes, was that replicated, that experience? Was that mimicked for current White House chief of staff, Reince Priebus?
It was, you know, going back to that meeting for Rahm, it was just an incredible occasion where you had every living chief except two come to the White House, you know, ranging from Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld to Leon Panetta and John Podesta, you know, to give Rahm, to show him, as Cheney put it, the keys to the men's room. You know, they've all been men so far. Someday we'll have a female White House chief. It was an extraordinary meeting, and it was born out of that crisis where we were on the verge of a Great Depression. It was really a kind of a stunning display of bipartisanship, if you can believe that. So now fast forward 8 years to December 2016. 10 former White House chiefs came to give Reince Priebus advice at the invitation of the outgoing chief, Dennis McDonough. And they all had one thing, one message that they wanted to communicate above all else, and that is the White House chief has to be first among equals in the White House in order to execute the president's agenda and tell him what he doesn't want to hear. Unfortunately, Priebus took notes. He seemed earnest, but we haven't seen that happen in this White House yet.
No, we sure haven't. Chris Whipple, author of the brand new book, The Gatekeepers, talking about how the White House chief of staffs define every presidency. I want to ask you, it's interesting to me because in your book, one of the things that comes crystal clear, and this was a consensus takeaway from all of the people that served in the position for the most part, was that the person who created the most effective and efficient system for chief of staffs was actually somebody who at some point served in the federal penitentiary for crimes committed in the White House. Tell us who that was and why it's regarded to this day as the best practice for how a chief of staff should run his White House.
Yeah, the book is about this incredible cast of characters. You know, I mean, Aaron Sorkin couldn't have dreamed these guys up, you know, beginning with H.R. Bob Haldeman, who was Nixon's infamous chief of staff, infamous because he was blamed for the biggest scandal in American political history, Watergate. And for sure, his fatal flaw was that he didn't stop the cover-up. But having said that, the other fascinating thing about Haldeman is that all of his successors give him credit for having created the template for the modern chief, the modern empowered chief. They all say Haldeman understood it better than anybody. He knew how to execute the president's agenda. He knew how to be a gatekeeper and give Nixon time to think. He knew how to control the paper flow and be an honest broker of information to Nixon. These are things that are really critical, and every president who has strayed from that model, including the current one, every president who thinks he can run the White House by himself regrets it in the end.
Well, you know, Chris Whipple, as you touch on that, the other thing that becomes crystal clear in the book is that there is a right way and a wrong way, or an approach that has proven itself over the years, an approach that has proven disastrous over the years. The other approach is called the spoke in the wheel system. Tell us a little bit about that, and I'm going to have a follow-up with you on what you think our current administration's approach is.
Yeah, you know, the notion that you can run the White House like a Manhattan real estate firm with a bunch of strong advisors at war with one another and, you know, making decisions, creative chaos or tension, that might work in the real estate business. It's a formula for failure in the White House, and it's been tried before. You know, Jerry Ford had five or six in the beginning when he became the so-called accidental president after Nixon's resignation. He had five or six advisors, all of them with equal access to the White House, and he called it the spokes of the wheel with the president at the center. It was a disaster. I mean, it was chaos and dysfunction, and within a month, Ford abandoned it. That was when he brought in an ambitious guy named Don Rumsfeld, who really knew how to make the trains run on time.
You know, one of the other things, speaking of Rumsfeld, that just popped out of this book for me. And again, I mean, I was riveted from the moment I opened it up until the very end. I literally did not stop reading it at one point, but it seems like you made a lot of news, a lot of revelations in your candid interviews with many of the people, some of them even not necessarily chiefs of staff themselves. But you talk about Don Rumsfeld. I was shocked at the comments of Colin Powell in your interview with him, not only how he felt about Rumsfeld, but also Dick Cheney and the role that George W. Bush's chief of staff at the time, Andrew Card, played or did not play when it came to creating the environment for the run-up to the war in Iraq. Tell us about the Powell revelations in your book.
Yeah, these guys were extraordinarily candid. Obviously, I've spent a lot of time talking to all 17 chiefs, two presidents, and many secretaries of state. I happened to also talk to every living CIA director in the course of researching the book. The story about the Iraq war that's never been told before, to give you context, Andy Card really had, I think, mission impossible as White House chief for Bush 43 because he had to deal with, talk about a rat blank, he had to deal with a very powerful Vice President Dick Cheney, the Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld. They were at war with Secretary of State Colin Powell. And James Baker, the former chief of staff, who everybody considers the gold standard, was so concerned about this. And so was Bush 41, the president's father. And they were so concerned that Baker made a secret private visit to Colin Powell with Bush 41's blessing, and said to him, you need to go into the president and tell him this is not what you signed up for. In other words, to fall on his sword. And as Baker told me, he never did it.
You know, and what's incredible about that story is when it comes to the man who a lot of people thought was the mastermind of the run-up to the war in Iraq, Dick Cheney, the vice president at the time. A lot of people don't know this, but as you highlight in your book, he himself, a former White House chief of staff, which made him really a double threat or a dual threat because of his formidable relationship with the president, but also his intimate knowledge of how the White House West Wing runs, having been chief of staff. You also reveal, Chris Whipple, that Dick Cheney almost went sort of a personality transformation from when he was chief of staff to when he was vice president. When we come back, we're going to talk about that and also more with Chris Whipple. If you want to speak to him, 866-610-6397. Truly the author of one of the best books on politics I've read recently, a must read. The book is entitled The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chief of Staffs Define Every Presidency. We're back with more Chris Whipple on News Radio 610 WIOD after this.
Standing by to refresh your news feed at the top and bottom of the hour.
Be in the know and to learn something.
News Radio 610 WIOD.
Fran Amani back on News Radio 610 WIOD, continuing our conversation with Chris Whipple, who is the author of a brand new book called The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Could not be any more timely. And in the process, he was able to talk to many members of this unique fraternity, including Rahm Emanuel, Dick Cheney, Leon Panetta, and Donald Rumsfeld. And we left the question in the air for Chris Whipple. One of the things he talks about in his book is that Dick Cheney was a very different man as chief of staff than when he was vice president. And it also soured a lot of his political relationships in the process. What happened to Dick Cheney, Chris Whipple?
You know, Dick Cheney is a great untold story. Back in his 20s, he was a real down-and-out ne'er-do-well, if I can use that old-fashioned term. I mean, he'd been thrown out of college twice. He was drinking heavily while working on power lines out in Wyoming. One morning, he wakes up face down in a jail cell and decided he'd better do something with his life. And he winds up as a political grad student, goes to Washington. Don Rumsfeld takes him under his wing and makes him his deputy in the Ford White House. Now, then he became chief of staff for the last year of Ford's presidency, and he was, believe it or not, the most popular guy in town. Everybody loved Dick Cheney, including the press corps. He had a wicked sense of humor. He loved to pull pranks on reporters. He was the guy you wanted in the room to reach consensus. So ever since, the chiefs of staff have been looking at each other and saying, what the heck happened to that guy? And there are a lot of theories. One is that, his old friend Brent Scowcroft, Bush 41's national security advisor, thinks it was his heart condition. He says that's what a bad heart will do to somebody. Others think it was 9/11. Cheney was always, you know, to the right of Genghis Khan, as somebody put it politically, even when he was Ford's chief. But, you know, obviously in the Bush 43 White House, he was a very different guy. Part of it is that probably that he had nothing left to lose. He wasn't running for office. He saw it as the last stop in his political career, and he could afford to tell people what he thought of them point blank, no sugarcoating. But he was an extremely powerful vice president under 43, and having been chief of staff for Jerry Ford, of course, he was a great bureaucratic infighter and really could do circles around Andy Card.
Chris Whipple, the presidency just completed by Barack Obama, I think he had four chiefs of staff in his 8 years. I'm thinking of Rahm Emanuel, Bill Daley, Jacob Lew, and of course Dennis McDonough, who finished as his final chief of staff. Was he well served by his chiefs? I know in the book you suggest that one of them wasn't really a good fit almost from day one.
Well, Obama understood something that our current president does not, that Jimmy Carter did not. And that is, he understood that he needed an empowered White House chief. It's the only way you can govern. You got to have a strong White House chief. And I think Rahm Emanuel was a pretty good one for the first, the beginning of Obama's term. He had to pass a lot of stuff. He had to get things done on Capitol Hill. He was on the verge of a Great Depression. He needed a huge stimulus which Rahm was able to do. Rahm knew the hill. And the great Rahm is a great story. You know, he was so famously aggressive about getting stuff done. As Leon Panetta put it, Rahm took the hill. You know, there would be dead bodies in his wake, but he took the hill. And he did that for Obama. Bill Daley, who succeeded Rahm, was an awkward fit because he hadn't been in Washington, hadn't really for a long time. He'd worked as Commerce Secretary under Clinton, but he wasn't quite up to speed on the new, you know, the warp speed of modern government. And he clashed with a number of, you know, the Chicago Mafia, among others, who were in the White House. And as Erskine Bowles, Clinton's chief, memorably put it to me, you know, that cabal, that little group in the White House that surrounds the president, they control the information flow, and information is power. And if you don't pay attention to them, they will spit your ass out, as he put it.
A lesson I think Steve Bannon is coming to learn, and maybe even Reince Priebus, when you think about who the Trump cabal is. And I think, is it fair to say, as you mentioned, every White House has those. In your diagnosis, is Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump, and the Trump sons right now the beating heart of that Trump cabal of insiders in this White House?
I think the problem with this White House is that it just isn't clear that anybody is in charge or that anybody has Donald Trump's ear, and that's a formula for failure. It's not the first time we've seen this kind of situation. I mean, Jim Baker, when he was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, as I say, everybody considers him the gold standard. He had, the right wing, the so-called true believers, led by Ed Meese, coming at him with everything they had. Baker was the hated pragmatist in their view. He wouldn't let Reagan be Reagan. The truth was, Reagan was a lot like Baker. He was a pragmatist. But anyway, Baker was smart enough and savvy enough to befriend Nancy Reagan. He made her an ally, the first lady. She was famously called the personnel director, had huge influence. And he befriended Mike Deaver, who was practically family. He was the deputy chief of staff, who was such a genius at orchestrating all of Reagan's events. Because of those alliances, he was able to really function effectively as Reagan's chief. But I don't see any evidence that Reince Priebus is a Jim Baker.
Chris Whipple, in our remaining seconds, you hinted that James Baker, regarded by all of the former chiefs as the gold standard, the best that has had the position as chief of staff. Who, in your opinion, based on your interviews, holds the dubious distinction as being the worst chief of staff of the modern era?
That's an easy call, actually. James Baker's successor, Donald Regan, who was the Treasury Secretary. This was the most disastrous job swap in history because Baker and Regan literally swapped jobs. Regan was so arrogant and so regal, he liked to have himself announced when he walked into the room. He was oblivious to the scandal that was hatching in the White House basement that became known as Iran-Contra. And Iran-Contra never would have happened, in my opinion, on Jim Baker's watch. But that's how consequential that position, White House Chief of Staff, can be.
Chris Whipple, thanks so much for joining us. And folks, I'm not kidding. You got to pick up this book. It is not a boring political dry read. This is as exciting and interesting as it gets. Lots of surprises. And the biggest surprise for me, Chris Whipple, was that Rahm Emanuel was not the author of Rat Funk. I'll let everybody else read the book to figure out the rest. Thanks so much for joining us, Chris Whipple.
My pleasure. Thanks
again.
Right.
We'll have you back again for sure. But when we come back, it's your chance to win a pair of tickets to President Trump's first 100 days town hall, hosted by yours truly, with special VIP guests Roger Stone and John Schindler, here in South Florida at the iHeart Southwest Airlines soundstage on News Radio 610 WIOD.
iHeart Radio is the easy-to-use app for music and radio. Download the free iHeart Radio app today.
Things that people do.
Brandon Amani back on News Radio 610 WIOD. Scotty, I'm feeling generous on this Monday morning. I don't know about you, but we're getting a lot of people saying, hey, when are you going to give them more tickets away? They want to go to this town hall. Can you believe the demand that exists for this town hall? Scotty.
I actually can believe it. I mean, with the kind of guests that we have coming in for this, I think so.
No, I got to admit, though, I mean, Roger Stone is a coup in and of himself to get him into this town hall, because we know he's perhaps regarded as one of the most influential behind-the-scenes guys, if not the ultimate behind-the-scenes Trump insider. But, you know, Roger's been on the show with us before. He's a friend of the program, blah, blah, blah. To have gotten John Schindler, who right now is the must-follow on Twitter. Everybody is following at 20 Committee, which is John Schindler's Twitter handle. He's now up to about 200,000 folks because he's become the Trump-Russia guy. This is the guy that's along with guys like Malcolm Nance and others. They're breaking all of the stories days and weeks and even in some cases months before it happens. And he does not suffer fools gladly, nor does Roger. So the fact that those two are going to be in the room together duking it out over how successful or unsuccessful these first 100 days of the Trump presidency has been will be a sight to behold. That's
how
one of those nights where...
Have we figured out how far we actually have to keep them apart? And are you sitting in the middle of them?
I was just going to say, like, that's one of those nights. Like, my job is an easy one. I just got to light the match and watch it burn. No, I'll be in the middle, of course. And, you know, I don't expect a Berkeley-style protest where there's going to be fisticuffs or anything. But there's going to be some verbal jousting. Because the other thing about these two guys, both of them were gifted with the silver tongue gift of gab. John Schindler and Roger Stone. I mean, that's what makes this such a compelling hot ticket. But folks, you can't buy your way in. We're not selling these tickets. We're only giving away a very select choice amount. So guess what, everybody? Your man Fernand's going to take care of you now. 866-610-6397. Caller number 6 at 866-610-6397 will win a pair of tickets to the town hall. It's going to be Monday, May 1st from 7 to 9 p.m., and we're doing it at the iHeart Southwest Airlines soundstage. Yours truly is going to be hosting the town hall, sponsored by WIOD and powered by our friends at Primary Care Physicians of Hollywood. So there you go. There you go, folks. Call in. Call number 6. You're going to see it in person. You're going to get to ask a question, and some of you may even get a chance to get an authored signed book, Roger Stone, the new book out, The Making of the President, 2016. Speaking of the making of the president, let's talk about the making of members of Congress, Scotty, because something happened over the weekend. You know, it's not so often that you get politicians to have one of these unguarded moments, right? Those moments where they say the truth about something, or at least how they feel about something. And it's one of those moments that, God forbid for them, if it happens in front of the unblinking eye, which is the video camera. Well, it happened to an Oklahoma Republican member of Congress. His name is Mark Wayne Mullen. And he was asked a question in one of these town halls. I guess to his credit, he's actually going to some of these town halls, unlike cowardly Marco Rubio, who has other priorities than to meet with the constituents that he represents in the United States Senate. Marco Rubio still will not do a town hall, because he's a coward. But Oklahoma Representative Mark Wayne Mullen has done some, to his credit, but he got caught saying something in this town hall. And we have the sound of it. Let's hear what he had to say, Scotty, about the question of who pays his salary.
One, you said you paid for me to do this. Bull crap, I paid for myself. I paid enough taxes before I ever got there and continue to through my company to pay my own salary. This is a service. No one here pays me to go. I do it as an honor, as a service.
But that salary,
guys, I'm just saying. Don't. This is a service for me, not a career. And I thank God this isn't how I make a living.
Give up your $158,000 then.
Hey, I have before. I've actually paid it back.
Every year would be great.
Now that's what's called foot in mouth syndrome, by Mark Wayne Mullen. And listen, I get it. Because look, you're under siege there. You're taking incoming flack from all angles. It's bad. It's ugly. And you're trying to hold your ground because you don't want to look like a little beta male in the process, right? You want to be the member of Congress who is willing to take the tough questions, but you also don't want to be a shrinking violet, because if that happens, then they put that image out all across the cable news and you look weak, and then you invite primary opposition or you invite a challenger in the general. But what Mark Wayne Mullen did there, Scotty, you caught what he did, right? You caught what he said. Did you catch his little verbal trick there, what he was trying to do?
I think so.
So he was saying, look, I've paid in my lifetime so much in federal taxes that you can't possibly say that you're paying me, even though we know a member of Congress makes, what is it, Scotty? It's like $175,000, $180,000 a year. And that's just the salary. Last I checked, there was no government, there was no private sector agency paying for that. That's coming out of my pocket and your pocket. And I haven't even gotten into all of the perks of the office that are also underwritten and paid for by the taxpayers. So when he says he had nothing to do with that salary being paid by the taxpayers, he should have just come out and said, hey, mea culpa, I made a mistake. Incredibly, it sounds like he's doubled down. Has he made a correction yet, Scotty? Has he come to the people and said, hey, I was wrong. Yes, you do pay my salary, and I work for you. I don't think he's done so yet.
His spokeswoman, after that little snafu he made, tried to do some damage control, telling local papers that his aspiration is to be a career legislator, not a career politician.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he's not being paid by the people. And by the way, members of Congress, you're not some prince regent or princess regent. It is a public service job. Where in the very definition of the word representative doesn't leave anything to the imagination. You are representing the interests of your constituents, the people that voted you into office. You are compensated by those constituents. You are compensated by those people at their own expense. And this is where this entitlement comes from.
Well, also, it's interesting that the Associated Press is reporting that back in 2009... he took $370,000 from the government as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act for his Mullen Plumbing Company that he...
Of course.
Oh, yeah, sure, he paid taxes, but he also took $370,000.
You know, this is like...
$370,000, you know.
This is like what is the lie that the pathological liar Trump says, you know, I'm not taking a salary. I'm not taking a salary. But, you know, he's gonna fleece us for, what is it, the $25 million already, not even 4 months into the gig, not to mention his wife, because she refuses to live in the White House, not exactly a slum house, right? We got to pay for her to live.
And I won't be playing golf.
He won't be playing golf, but we're paying $25 million thus far over the course of the presidency. If at this pace continues and he's reelected, almost $700 million it comes into. Just unbelievable. Speaking of winning, let's talk to a winner. The big winner of the next pair of tickets we just gave away. I understand his name is Dennis. Hey, Dennis, congratulations.
Thank you, Fernand. I appreciate it, man. I'm a big listener to your program. I've called in a couple times for serious stuff, sometimes for, you know, for some fun stuff with he said, she said.
Well, listen, we like to mix it up with the fun and the serious, because that's the name of the game when it comes to life. You can't be too serious and you can't be all fun all the time. But Dennis, tell me about it. Are you excited to go to the town hall? Roger Stone and John Schindler battling it out. That is some heavy duty fighting right there.
Extraordinary personalities, to say the least. And there's this curious construct or context, or however you want to say it, we always say that principles before personalities, you know, so how you structure this thing in keeping it in terms of principles is going to be interesting, because the personalities are going to want to get in, you know, that's going to come up. And well,
that's what's going to make for a riveting evening. I mean, I'm telling you, this is like a heavyweight. How old are you, Dennis? Do you mind if I ask your age?
59 years young.
Okay, so you know exactly what I'm talking about. You remember back in the day, like before cable TV and before pay-per-view, you had those like closed circuit boxing matches. Like you would pay a ticket just to go somewhere where you on a screen would watch the big fight, right?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me this is not like closed circuit TV worthy. Like this is kind of a ticket I'd pay money to see. You and I are going to see it for free because you won tickets. I'm going to get to moderate it. But is this not the type of battle royale you kind of wish our politics were about? Especially guys that have a lot of principle, but at the same time, a lot of personality as well, Dennis.
Exactly my point. And what kind of, you know, dare I use a 60s, 70s thing is that it's a mind blower on how the truth is put out there. You know, the facts are put out there, and yet the spin on them has been just whirlwind. The spin is just whirlwind. You know, Teflon Ron, you know, when President Reagan was in the office, they used to call him, you know, Teflon. You know, there was kind of a sliding, you know, comment about him. Now, what do you call Don here? What do you call, you know, super Teflon Don? I mean, just
no. You call him what I think he is, which is Con, the pathological liar. That's just one man's opinion. Nonetheless, Dennis, congratulations. Looking forward to meeting you in person and looking forward to giving you an opportunity to ask a question. Dennis, quick, before you run, give me your grade for President Trump, the first 84 days, the 85 days thus far. What's the grade you give the man?
Yep. And being such a critic of the guy from the I've been following Donald Trump since the 80s. Okay, so I've kind of admired him in some respects, you know, for what he's accomplished or his play, you know, his speeches or you know whenever they had him, you know, in the public arena, you know, I followed him for a long time. So there's some admiration there to some degree. Yet in the position that he's at now, C minus, man, I'm giving him, you know, that's a gift. I gift to him a C minus.
Oh my God! I think if you asked inside that room, and I know a lot of people that work there, if they could get away with a C minus, they would take that puppy and run with it. I know that's not the feeling eternally. Hey Dennis, thanks for the call. Congratulations! Remember, folks, you can also win by registering at WIOD.com. And also, when we come back, I want to ask the question I asked at the start of the show. Another tax day has passed, and we still have no idea what the president's taxes are. Do you think he should show his tax returns? Give us a call at 866-610-6397. When we come back on News Radio 610 WIOD, the Fernand Amondi Show.
One call at a time. News Radio 610 and online at WIOD.
Fernand Amondi back on News Radio 610 WIOD, and it was interesting because once again yesterday, President of the United States took to his great nemesis, Twitter. Shouldn't he have been in church yesterday morning? I don't think he went to church yesterday. You know, he's a big religious guy now. He never was before, but now he's all about Christendom and Christianity. So why wasn't he at church yesterday instead of tweeting? Because one of the things he wrote about yesterday was he wrote, I did what was an almost impossible thing to do for a Republican. Easily won the Electoral College. Yes, he did that. And he did win it. I don't know about easily, but he won it comfortably. You can't take that away. It was a comfortable Electoral College win. I'm very fair with the man. I don't lie to the people on this station or to this audience. So you got to give him his credit where it's due. Yes, but aren't we past that now? Like, isn't the election settled business? You lost the popular vote. You got crushed there. Historic margin, almost 3 million votes. But you won the Electoral College, and that's the rules of the game, okay? So you won fair and square by the rules. Why keep relitigating it? But that wasn't even the problem. The problem is, he says, now tax returns are brought up again? As if it's like an offense to him to bring up the question of where are your damn tax returns? Scotty's telling me we actually have information. Did he go to church yesterday?
He did go to church.
Okay, well, good. Good for you, Mr. President. I think you should spend a little bit more time in church as opposed to on your Twitter. I'm starting to think he might have been Twittering in church. You know, there's always a guy that does that, right? Or a gal. Like, you think that they're reading the prayer book, and those fingers are, like, magically scribbling away. It's not the prayer book. They're not flipping pages.
I'm not going to be hypocritical here. If I was in church, I'd probably be doing the same thing. So, I mean, listen, who am I to knock? Oh, me? I couldn't stay still for an hour or whatever.
You're a millennial, right? You want me to give you a fact? Listen to this. 35% of millennials, people in your generation, 35% have no religious affiliation. We've never seen a generation in American history that has basically given the middle finger to organized religion like the millennials do.
I'm surprised it's that low, to be honest with you.
You're surprised it's that low?
To be honest with you, yes.
You don't
people,
have any...
Out of the people I know, I know very few millennials that go to church.
Really?
I know very few. And I some of those people that once they have kids, I know they start going to church, but I literally, just thinking of my inner circle of friends, not one of them go to church. Some of them say they're religious. Some of them say, you know, but I don't know. No.
There are people listening right now whose hair is on fire.
Just
thought.
Being honest with you. Just I mean, like, it's just 35%. That seems low to me compared to what I know and people I know. Well, and,
but that's, think about, I mean, you say low. That's
no,
out of every three people, every third person is like, yeah, I don't believe it. I don't go to church. I don't care. I don't want to be bothered with organized religion.
Yeah. That's this generation.
Anyway, back to the storyline, though. You know, this guy who promised he was going to give his taxes. Remember what he says? Oh, it's under audit. That's what the con man does. He just keeps rolling away over and over and over again. What do you got, Scotty?
Yes, I will really gladly give them. They're not going to learn anything, but it's under routine audit. When the audit ends, I'm going to present them. That should be before the election. I hope it's before the election. But when the audit ends, I've had even journalists say that, no, nobody should give until audits are over. I've had journalists say that.
That was May of last year, by the way.
You know, it's just he's such a liar. You know, and how do you call yourself a Christian when you lie that much without impunity? You just lie. He's not going to show you his tax returns because he can't. He won't. He knows if you see him, it's over. It's curtains.
I'm a truth teller.
It's a joke.
Truth. All I do is tell the truth.
Yeah. All you do is play golf, sir. All you do is play golf. You don't tell the truth. Anyway, folks, good show today. I want to thank Jim Morin from the Herald for joining us. Two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Chris Whipple. That great book. You got to check it out. The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. I want to thank you, the listeners and the callers. Congratulate Mark and Dennis for being the big winners. We're going to give away two sets of tickets every day, folks. Don't forget, you get your chance to register at WIOD.com. I'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Peace.
I love playing the game.
News at the top and bottom of every hour and anytime it breaks.